As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Robert Shiller with us of Yale University. He is a laureate in this, that, and about 14 other things as well. John, I thought we'd wander into the land of tariffs.
Yeah.
And how that folds over into a national agony on wage growth.
What's actually quite interesting is that the president has actually scored his first win without much media coverage on trade, a revamped trade deal with South Korea, maybe small at the margin. But you do wonder whether this approach of this administration can generate results. Professor Shiller, can it?
Well, he's got people intimidated, and I think that it has an effect on negotiations. I mean, it may have a positive effect in other areas, like North Korea. He comes across as a kind of unpredictable, aggressive guy, and I think he does know something about negotiations.
Isn't that a really good point, though, Professor Shiller, that maybe some people are missing, that the approach towards China over the last 20 years hasn't resulted in any significant opening up of the Chinese economy under pressure just through talks, that this is probably the way to do it, using a stick rather than a carrot?
Well, I don't know. It's not my personality. I find unfamiliar territory to me. But I think that a good relationship with these countries is also very important, and we're suffering from that right now. I was just in China last week, and the sense that I got was these aggressive measures are generating some anger and hostility. Yeah.
The anger and hostility, professors, you've written in Finance and the Good Society and any of your other efforts, is a societal scream in America. All of our listeners know this, the haves and the have-nots. Paul Krugman yesterday dropped on us that concept of your classes, monopsony, which is a dominant coal mine miner in a coal mining town is the only employer, or maybe a rubber plantation in Malaysia where there's one rubber plantation and a lot of workers. Is America's agony here on trade actually about the monopsony of American business, where they almost can't raise wages because of the dominance of select businesses and industries?
I thought you were going to refer to our trade policy as exploiting monopsony, power.
We may be exploiting it in other countries, but is the agony that brings us to this trade debate because of a lack of wage growth in America partly from monopsonistic tendencies?
Oh, okay. There has definitely been a lack of wage growth. Is it because monopsonistic power has increased?
Yeah.
I don't know. I tend to, well, that it's undoubtedly a complicated story, but I think of important reasons why wage growth hasn't been inspiring is technological replacement, labor-saving devices, and B, globalization, which continues.
Do they dwarf the trade debate? I mean, when the president says trade deficits are bad, is that discussion, whether it's constructive or not, overwhelmed by technology?
Yeah, the general notion that trade deficits are bad is just not supported by economic theory. Trade deficits. A lot of people want to invest in the U.S., so that helps finance the trade deficit. I don't think. It seems like President Trump, in focusing so much on that measure, is misguided, just as he is in not respecting the World Trade Organization, which is a outgrowth of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in 1948. That was a post-World War II, post-Depression, post-World War II act of enlightenment. And now we're losing sight of that.
Professor, trade deficits can be a problem if they're persistent, drawn out over a long period of time, and if they're a consequence of subsidies and protectionism, which China front and center, right?
Right, right.
That's a problem.
Well, I think there are problems. I think Peter Navarro, who is Trump's advisor, makes it into more of a war type problem than there's something to be said for respect for other nations. I think we want China. I know it can be played as a cheat on American business, but on the other hand, we do want China to prosper. That ultimately helps international accord, and we're talking about another massive nuclear power here.
Yeah,
I think there could be more balance in our relations.
Thank you for the time today. Robert Schiller with us of Yale University. We are housing free there. Next time we'll beat him to death about the housing market. One of the great engineering programs of America is the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and that is where she was minted out of, where she studied her thermodynamics, and also a little bit, she probably quoted Python when she was there. Eileen Burbage joins us. She is, of course, definitive within the United Kingdom tech space, with a lot of experience with some of the tech giants over the years. We now speak with engineer Eileen Burbage. If you were to speak today, Eileen, to the leadership of a beleaguered American tech industry, what would you say to them?
Great question. First of all, I'd probably ask them if I could get any sort of tips on their future roadmaps. But I would then probably try and advise them that now is a really good sort of opportunity for them to really step up and to really demonstrate that they've got mindfulness and consumer sort of responsibility at the heart of what they do. I think that's what people are wanting to see. I think the markets are worried about, you know, over-regulation or overstepping from the regulators. And I really think the tech leadership can actually thwart that. I think they can preempt it if they sort of demonstrate and communicate that they're thinking about these issues and that they're not taking them too lightly.
Do you look at them as publicly traded shareholder responsible managements, or is their fiction of public ownership so great that they're basically private venture capitalists using the system while they do their tech stuff?
I do think, not to be led too much by your great question, but I do think they've probably been given a bit of a pass. And I think, you know, with the sort of voting rights and the extraordinary sort of setups that a lot of them have, they've benefited from not having quite as much scrutiny from the markets and from other shareholders as other.
Oh, come on. They're not John Cryan over at Deutsche Bank. I mean, that's what it comes out. John Farrell.
They're not John Cryan over at Deutsche Bank because Facebook delivered a return of 50% on the stock last
year. That would
be true.
John Farrell, jump in here.
I imagine it would be a bit different for Mark Zuckerberg if he hadn't. Eileen, the news coming from Facebook is that they're going to make it more straightforward for users to change their settings and delete data that they've already shared with the company. How big a move is that? And if that's the ultimate business model now, if you're allowed to delete the data as an end user, how do they monetize the platform as efficiently as they have over the last couple of years for the next couple of years with that a new policy setting?
Yeah, so I think it's a great step on their part, by the way, and that's the kind of reaction that I was sort of alluding to, where they've got an opportunity to do these things, right, and make meaningful interventions to demonstrate that they're leading from the front. I think that the business model's not going to change because it's all on a scale. It's all on a spectrum and all very relative. Should some users choose to delete all their data, Facebook, as an example, will still have more data on more people than any other platform in the world. And even should one delete their entire profile, they still will have the greatest ability to sort of target and offer insights to specific groups of people based on other behavior. So it's a bet worth taking, and it's actually an sort of a feature and an option for users, which they probably should have had all along.
There is an overarching concern among some analysts out there, Eileen, on Facebook specifically, that maybe we're meeting this point of saturation for ad growth. Are we anywhere near to that?
I don't think so, but even I've been skeptical about sort of Facebook's ability to keep sustaining the growth that they've seen over recent years, and obviously I've been proven wrong time and time again. So I don't think what's happening now is a reason to think that they're going to be at saturation point. I think this is a minor setback and actually has much more to do with communications and user responsibility.
There's Silicon Fen in the United Kingdom, or I guess Cambridge Cluster is one way to call it. Do they have the same arrogance over there, or is it discrete to Silicon Valley, the mess that we see Silicon Valley in?
Well, I think there's no other place in the world that's quite like Silicon Valley, and I think the culture is different in Silicon Valley, having been there a number of years. We've got Silicon Roundabout, but we also have a number of great hubs across the UK, and I do think it's a different culture for sure, but there's lots to learn from both sides, to be honest.
So, that was diplomatic. Eileen, come on. How can, within the competitive landscape, whether it's an island in the East River of New York, Good Morning Cornell University, or it's what's going on over in the United Kingdom, how do you people take advantage of the chaos Mr. Zuckerberg has wrought?
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, there are great advantages. Even if you weren't to think about data privacy and data protection, we've got great policymakers who think about things like this in advance. So GDPR, that's going to be coming out in Europe.
Yeah.
But even specific subsectors. So if you look at fintech or financial services, you know, the policymakers here have been really helpful for innovation and have been working sort of in step with the industry. That helps a lot.
See, that, John Farrell, that was just a window into how vicious Eileen Burbidge can be. You see how
Eileen
she said it was just fantastic.
Eileen is the nicest person in the world of tech I've possibly had anything to
do with ever. She would claw out Mark Zuckerberg's eyes in a heartbeat.
Come on, when are we going to talk about cricket?
Well, don't encourage him, Eileen, please. Please don't encourage him. Apparently the captain has been banned for the Australian team for 12 months, I understand.
Continue, Mr. Ferris.
Yes,
save
I know. We're not going down the cricket road. Eileen, looking forward, thinking about someone that might get shredded and have their eyes pulled out, could be Zuckerberg, and it could be in front of Congress. The reports of the last 24 hours leading us to believe that the CEO of Facebook will have his day on the Hill. And I just wonder, Eileen, as an investor, how nervous investors should be about that, given that we know this is a man that's incredibly uncomfortable under pressure in those kind of situations.
You know, I don't know how investors would feel. I would actually caution them that there's not too much concern here. I think he will be extremely well-briefed, really well-prepped. He'll be sort of trained and conditioned to answer appropriately. And I actually think it's a good chance for sort of the air to be cleared, in that there's not going to be anything that's going to come out that's going to be hugely detrimental. I think it's going to be a very straightforward, you know, here's what our T's and C's always allowed for. This is what happened. Yes, we will now take greater responsibility to make sure it's easier to understand, and we have taken these steps from A to Z already. And so I actually think it's going to be a pretty strong opportunity for Facebook to say, we did things correctly. We probably should have communicated even better about those things. And we will do our best to sort of help audit, monitor, and verify that these things are being abided by even more so in the future.
Eileen, one final question, if we could. Give us an update on how you see the continent of Europe's tone of regulation of technology, their reticence about the dominance of technology. Is that a trend that's growing? Is it stable, or is it just a moment for them?
I think it's relatively stable. And to be honest, just sort of being on this side of the pond, I think it's been pretty consistent. So I haven't seen, you know, for instance, say a spike up or anything like that. I think it's been relatively consistent, whether they're looking at tax treatment or they're looking at data rights and data protection. They've been consistent, and it just does happen that the largest tech companies and the ones that are squarely in the sights of where they might want to set examples or try and use for case study, it's going to be the American companies. You know, I think what will be interesting is if they start to take a look at, you know, maybe what companies from Asia are starting to do as they become more influential, or they start to increase their user bases sort of over here in Europe as well. But I think they would do the same, by the way, for a company that's coming out of Europe as well.
Eileen, thank you so much. Eileen Burbidge, a great, great, great briefing there with Passion Capital, and of course with her perspective, transatlantic perspective on technology.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
For Global Wall Street, this is a great interview. Futures up 6, Dow futures up 68. Mark Connors and the Credit Suisse team in, I love this title, Prime Services, Risk and Portfolio Advisory Market Color. And we're going to protect the copyright. We don't send it out. It is a spectacular detailed report on what hedge funds are actually doing. And Mark, I love what you summarize, puzzling positions. I mean, it's a mess right now, right?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we always like to have one theme because that, you know, not many people are can take on three different ideas at once. But when you look at the rates positioning, which now we see funds net long the 10-year, why would that be when we're stair-stepping up to, you know, 7 or 8 moves over the next 2 years and people are selling base metals when we have, you know, inflation and they yeah. are selling banks and we're expecting yield curve to rise.
You got all these esoteric things, master index, long, short, market neutral, blah, blah, blah. The trend guys and the commodity futures guys, they're getting hammered. Why is that?
So they January was one of the best months they had, right? But January is years ago in the world of markets. And then they got hammered, to your point, in February. But one reason why we are pretty constructive is that they got washed out. So these folks are trend followers, and they can really ramp up the equity positioning. And they took it down in Feb. They went down to a bottom decile positioning. So we don't think that we're going to have much follow-through beyond where we are today on the equity markets.
What's the mood in raising money right now? I don't want to go into the, you know, the nitty-gritty of Credit Suisse and what you're doing in prime brokerage, but can people start a hedge fund now, or is it just brutal out there because people have to see 14 years of track record for you to get, you know, X million of dollars going?
That's always going to be the case about track record. Yeah, that's great. We love your system. We love your setup and your pedigree, your space that you're in. But give me a call in 18 to 36 months when you, you know, and that's when your heart sinks. So what we're seeing is a lot of platforms are seeding folks and having them in-house. So they're letting the hedge fund keep their name, keep the track record if they do well, but they're going to share in the economics. Right. So the big are getting bigger is what we see.
And Mark, the active guys must be loving this. I mean, the last couple of months, they must be in a better place with a VIX north of 20.
So what we saw was the reason why people couldn't make money was the great compression of 2000, sort of post Q1 16, where it was all a monolithic move higher.
Yeah.
Everything went higher. So now you have dispersion, but it's a be careful what you wish for because not everyone's able to monetize the vol, right? And so it's...
Yeah, let's talk about that because I want volatility. And then all of a sudden it's, I don't want this kind of volatility. Is this good vol, so to speak, or is it bad vol?
It is. So let's just look at returns, right? So what Tom was talking about with returns earlier in the master index. Hedge funds only caught about 40% of the downside of Feb. So market was down, hedge funds were down, only 40% of it. March is going to be the test.
Yeah.
So we're going to find out, you know, we chaff who the adults are in the room about how they did in March.
How do you respond as a grizzled prime brokerage strategist and analyst when you see the media frenzy over a few select ginormous hedge fund players, whether they're up X percent or down Y percent? When you see them, you know, I want to pick on Mr. Ackman right now. When you see that focus on a few guys, how does a grizzled pro like you respond to that?
You step back and you say, definitely a segment of the market, an individual, high profile, but you know, we don't speak about specific managers in case they're clients.
Sure.
We look at the hedge fund space, still 3.1, 3.2 trillion. That doesn't even speak to the alternative beta spaces that are derivative, that some of these managers are also rolling in. They're becoming businesses. So a lot of these clients are no longer single strats, but they are multiple strategies down the margin.
And I would suggest in the real world of hedge funds, people are more diversified than the headline grabbing bets that the media is fixated on. Do I have that right?
You did. You got to it quicker than I did. So that's why. And you're exactly right. People are no longer saying, you know what, I'm going to bet against, you know, going back decades, I'm going to bet against a certain currency pair.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to bet on a certain, that is out the window.
I mean, John, let me translate this for you. When you're at Le Bill Bouquet having the Cajun chicken.
I don't know what you're talking about.
A week, when you're at Le Bill Bouquet and, you know, they introduce you to a hedge fund guy, he's way more diversified typically and way more managing his risk than all the headline grabbing alternative investment guys.
Just for the record, I've only ever been to that restaurant three times, and those three times, you took me. Okay? I never took myself. You took me, for the record.
I have good morning. No idea where that restaurant
is. I know. We say good morning to Reto, keeper of the Amex. Continue.
Did you expense that, did you? Okay, you're in trouble. Mark Connors, how important was it that the Treasury market actually took a bid yesterday in a risk-off move, in a significant way? We had a bit of one last week, but actually, finally, the Treasury market acted as a shock absorber in the traditional way. How important was that?
So that's very important because, as you know, Tom was talking about the diversified hedge fund world, not everyone is in equity long short. Some folks are playing that cross asset. And so when those breaks hit, it is constructive and acts as a breaker in the market. So one reason why a note we went out today to some clients was we think the market's acting well. We're not seeing a Q1 16 deleveraging, which was massively destructive to the alternative space. Worst month in 5 years.
Something that I think a lot of people will pick up on from listening to you was something you said about the positioning of some of these hedge funds. There is a narrative out there that the market in its entirety is net short treasuries and net short the US dollar in quite a significant way. But I heard you say something very different about the funds that you cover and about the positioning of those funds in those markets. Just walk me through it and what's driving it.
Yeah, it's a time frame. We think it's a tactical move. And whether it's a lower for longer narrative over the outs, you know, for a period of time of 1, 2, 3 months, but it is absolutely opposite what the narrative is of rates higher, who wants to be long a 10-year when 3% is a given. We went out with this when it was 291 and we're 275. So they got it right. So CTAs are making money on rates now.
Okay.
And that's why people like a CTA sleeve.
Right.
When they're long equities, they're counterbalanced.
For those of you, CTAs are trend-based. Good morning, Monroe Trout, if you're listening, and John Henry of the Red Sox. Trend-based people, that seems where my head is as well. How are the quants doing? How are the math, the studs out of Courant, NYU, or out of Carnegie Mellon? How are the quants doing?
It's a wide dispersion. Some having a tough year. Again, back to the volatility, they're not monetizing it. And whether because they had a tilt to the long side in the, you know, given what's happened in 17 with it being a
right.
So where are they? Flat to either side of 2% of zero.
Yeah, one question, we're going to come back with you and keep this going. What is the short everybody wants now? They call up, they go, well, we're going to give you our prime brokerage, but we got to get shares in. What's that? It's not Krispy Kreme, right?
Right.
I mean, we're past Krispy Kreme.
Thank God, right?
Because Tesla, what's the short now? I got to get 4 million shares short. Go.
Right. So we can't talk single names.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I know.
No one's listening.
My phone's already buzzing, so thank you on that one. I'll speak a little broader. The
Please.
Shorts are working. So For 2.5 years, you saw short underperformance eat away at alpha. I mean, hedge funds weren't producing alpha a lot because of shorts. That changed mid-17. And whether it was the advent of fiscal policy, tax initiatives, what have you, or rates, we did see shorts start to add to the bottom line. So whatever names you want to say, there is more interest in
well,
that area.
Have a Krispy Kreme donut and we'll come back. Mark Connors with us with Credit Suisse as we look at prime brokering. We now get brighter and smarter with Michael Mayo at Wells Fargo, and he's dragged along Elyse Greenberg. We're going to talk about BB&T, which is his own twisted story here. But Mike, I got to rip up the script and spend a good amount of time here on, you don't follow Deutsche Bank, but you can certainly talk about European banking. In your BB&T research note, you talk about how they had to go out and, quote, reduce expenses by 6% year over year. European banks really can't do that, can they?
Well, the U.S. banks took their medicine after the financial crisis and much of this decade, slimmed down the infrastructure, raised capital, just managed better for profitability. And that's a big contrast to the European banks, which are less efficient, lower returns, less capital, and just did not take their medicine.
With your decades of experience, are they that way because of the cultural realities of those nations and those peoples in society? Or are they just afraid to be like BB&T or Bank of America or JP Morgan?
Well, there are cultural and political differences that make it more difficult. But I'd also think that the U.S. regulators did a better job at forcing the issue with the U.S. banks. And as strong as the European regulators have been, it's not like one central regulator that's forcing the European banks to get to where they need to be.
Lisa wants to jump in here, but I got one more question here on Deutsche Bank. The idea here that something radical is going to happen, the easiest way to change things is the geographical change. Do you predict that any of the troubled banks, whether it's Deutsche Bank or the other list of European banks, that they're going to make geographical choices to get out of certain things in certain geographies?
Well, you've seen that with the U.S. banks. You know, I've been here talking about Citigroup, a stock that we recommend. But the U.S. is the place to be right now. And especially with some deregulation, U.S. looks a lot more favorable than Europe. And so the European banks need to pick their spots to improve that efficiency, to improve their returns, to get closer to where the U.S. banks are right now. The U.S. banks have extended the lead in capital markets.
Cool. Lisa, they should build a skyscraper on Park Avenue.
Like JP Morgan. One question that I have, I'm watching the perpetual bonds of Deutsche Bank, and they had kind of a freak out in the past couple of years as people started to worry that this could become a capital issue. It certainly is a profitability issue with Deutsche Bank. When does it become a capital issue?
Look, the U.S. banks have the strongest balance sheets in a generation. Certainly, the global banking system is stronger, and that includes the European banks. So the idea of the next financial crisis, it's been 10 decades. We're past that stage. The foundation's solid. The issue, when we compare the European banks, the U.S. banks, is really a profitability and efficiency one.
You know, I do want to just get your thoughts on the 2-10s yield curve spread, which is the narrowest that it's been since 2007. This is usually a key indicator for profitability of U.S. banks. How worried are you about this?
Well, I know a lot of investors look at, you know, the flatter yield curve and say, uh-oh, look out for the banks. But that's one of many factors driving banks. And that's kind of the typical way of looking at it. But what we're seeing for the U.S. banks is a 25-year structural breakout for the benefits of scale. A lot of people care there. So in terms of, you had national banking for the first time in 1994. This is the first time in 25 years when you can be a national bank without the distractions of big system integrations or financial crisis or new regulations. Okay. So we're looking at the structural changes as opposed to the cyclical factor of flatter yield curve. But some people care about that.
I was kidding. It was a joke that I have with my producer, Rich Truman. We're going back and forth on the huge headline flow. Dow up 105 points. Let us migrate to something, and I give you great credit for this, both Mike Mayo and Elise Greenberg, here, of not looking at the top six banks. Where does BB&T fit in? They're a regional bank? Is that a good place to start?
So BB&T is a different animal. They are the 10th largest bank. They're a regional bank. They're mostly in the Southeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Texas. But what's unique about this bank is that they own the 5th largest insurance broker in the world. And it's a little less than 1/5 of their revenues. So as a bank analysts don't know a whole lot about the insurance
space. Got that right.
Yeah. So we collaborate with Elise Greenspan. So I talked to my colleague, Elise Greenspan, and said, what do you think of this insurance business? What's happening in the insurance world? And that's where she came in. And by the way, Tom, yesterday we upgraded BB&T for the first time in many years to market outperform. We're buyers now at BB&T.
Okay. What's it like working with Mike Mayo? Do they have to medicate you before you work with Michael Mayo? I mean, it's his experience, right?
They do not. He's very experienced, and he's a pleasure to work with. We collaborate a lot across Wells Fargo Securities.
What's the distinction of their insurance company?
So the distinction is they're an insurance broker. So essentially, they're not taking on any underwriting risk.
They're not doing the Bermuda thing.
They're not doing the Bermuda thing. That's the host of companies in Bermuda are companies that underwrite risk. So when there is losses, like all the losses we had last year, there's exposure and they're going to take a big loss. A broker is essentially placing the business. That's what they're, that's their role. And so they can benefit, like BB&T is positioned to benefit from a firmer pricing environment, means rates are going up. So if we take a step back here, last year was the highest cat loss year ever for the industry.
That's catastrophe bond or catastrophe generally.
Catastrophe losses.
Yeah.
So
that.
Anything that caused a big event, you had earthquakes, you had hurricanes, you had fires. It was essentially the triple whammy for the industry. Three events that hit in 1 year. And so essentially you saw the largest level of losses. Pricing power has come back to the sector. And it's really to the benefit of insurance brokers like BB&T, as well as some other you know, large insurance brokers themselves.
Is this a way of saying that they can charge people a lot more to get covered?
Yeah. So essentially, I mean, you need losses to push for higher prices. In the absence of losses, it had been many years before we actually saw a very large, significant hurricane. And so there is no pricing power if there's no losses.
Is your interest here of the regional bank with the insurance brokerage that they would spin it off or sell it out to someone? Or is it really a corpus of BB&T?
No, I think it's something that's unique to BB&T. It's a capital light business that's different than the rest of their bank business. And so essentially, I think they like the diversification that they have here. And they're looking at this as an opportunity to grow their revenue, to expand their margins, and essentially to increase the earnings they're seeing from this business, as opposed to looking to sell it. So I would not expect the sale of their insurance business.
And what Elise shares with me, Tom, is that these companies, the pure plays that she covers in the insurance area, are often valued about 1/4 higher than banks. So this is a premium business that BB&T has. And again, it's unique among, you know, all the banks.
Michael Mayo with us with Wells Fargo and Elise Greenspan as well. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.